We get to start this morning with a little bit of a history lesson. I'm a history professor, so sorry, it happens sometimes. In the American Revolution, there is a famous battle known as the Battle of Saratoga. If any of you are familiar with the American Revolution, good for you. If you're not, study your history. That's how we became independent. At least that's how we used to be independent. The Battle of Saratoga, we win the Battle of Saratoga. The French are so impressed that we won the Battle of Saratoga that the French entered the war on the side of the colonies, and a world war ensued that we didn't care anything about as long as the French sent us money and supplies, which they did in small amounts. But what is significant about the Battle of Saratoga is that the general who was in command at the Battle of Saratoga was a guy by the name of Horatio Gates. Horatio Gates at the Battle of Saratoga sat in his tent and drank. He was so afraid of losing that battle that Horatio Gates sat in his tent and drank while his two subordinates took command of the army and won the victory. Those two subordinates were Daniel Morgan, who was famed for his victory at the Battle of the Cowpens, portrayed poorly by Mel Gibson in The Patriot. And the other guy was a guy that you may know very well. His name is Benedict Arnold. Silence! At the Battle of Saratoga, Benedict Arnold was shot in the leg. His horse was actually shot out from under him. The bullet went through Arnold's leg, killed his horse. The horse fell on Arnold, breaking his leg. He commandeered another horse and with a bullet wound and a broken leg led American soldiers to victory over a large French army at the Battle of Saratoga. When the battle was over, Arnold got no credit, or Daniel Morgan for that matter. Neither of them got credit for the victory, but Horatio Gates stumbled out of his tent and went, "I won!" Arnold was so furious at not getting any credit for his victory, that he eventually let that anger fester until he betrayed the colonies and became the most famous traitor in American history. Later on, Benedict Arnold would go to command a British regiment in raids throughout the colony of Virginia. When asked one day by a colonial officer, a Virginia farmer, was standing in his field, and this guy said, "If you could get hold of Benedict Arnold, what would you do?" He said, "I would cut off his leg and bury it with full military honors, and then I would burn the rest of him alive." That's Benedict Arnold. This is how we normally look at people that we consider to be traitors. There is a tremendous amount of animosity, a tremendous amount of hatred, vitriol. We normally want to see some sort of vengeance. In fact, even today in the United States, if you were convicted of treason, it is a capital offense. By the way, anybody know the last people in the United States convicted and executed for treason? I think it's the Rosenbergs. The Rosenbergs back during the Cold War. Now, here's why this is relevant. Today we're going to be looking at a passage from Mark chapter 2, beginning in verse 14. This is the call of Levi, or Matthew as he is better known. Now, this is a really important story in the New Testament. It's one that we don't normally give enough attention to, because we just go, "Oh, Jesus was calling guys all the time, and he called Matthew, big deal." But this is really significant, especially in light of some things that are going on right now. I watched the other day as two Christian guys got into a Facebook argument. They would probably call it a debate, but it looked like an argument to everybody else watching it, about whether or not Christians should or should not support particular political candidates or parties, and they got in this thing. And of course, you know, on Facebook, when somebody posts something, everybody who's friends with them on Facebook feels obligated to comment because they all want to be part of the party. And so literally this thing turned into something which was comical and entertaining for those of us who were just spectators. And all I could think about is, as this thing got uglier and uglier as it kind of progressed, was what would Jesus think about people in his church fighting over the stuff we fight about? And so I thought about this text. So in verse 14 it says, as Jesus passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax booth, and he said to him, follow me. And he got up and followed him. Can you turn me down a little bit, Donald? I'm hearing a lot of feedback up here. Thank you. So here's what happens. He says, Jesus is walking by and he looks in a tax booth. Now, we don't know at this point how many of the 12 disciples are with Jesus. We know Matthew isn't yet. But we know four that are. Peter, Andrew, James, and John at this point have been called by Jesus to be fishers of men. Now, if you own a fishing business in the area around Capernaum, it is a safe bet that you pay taxes to Rome, right? I mean, it's a safe bet. So it's a fairly safe bet that if Peter, Andrew, James, and John don't know Matthew personally, and if you've seen The Chosen, they kind of depict it as the fact that they did in fact know him personally. If they didn't know him personally, they knew some of his accomplices. Now, it's important to note that tax collectors in this period generally were fairly wealthy. And one of the reasons they were wealthy is that they were given permission within a particular range to cheat people. Essentially, your profit came from overtaxing people and you got to keep what did not belong to Rome. So if somebody was supposed to pay, say, 100 shekels, and you could bilk them out of 130 shekels, you got to keep the 30 shekels, and you sent the other 100 to Rome like you were supposed to. And so the better a cheat you were, the more money you made. So I want you for a moment to imagine that you are one of these fishermen, one of these four guys, and Jesus has called you to be fishers of men. And he's supposed to be the Messiah. He is going to lead this great thing against Rome. And he's going to create all this incredible stuff for Israel. And we have dropped everything and we followed him. And he's going to pick guys like us, loyal Jews who love Israel, who love the law. And he's going to pick those guys and we're going to go out and we're going to do this amazing thing. We're not even sure what it is. And then you're walking through Capernaum and you walk past the tax booth. And Jesus is I kind of picture Jesus being up in the front and the other guys behind him. And as they're walking towards the tax booth, you probably in the back get something like this. I hate that guy. That guy, he's such a cheat. He's a traitor. And if you are a Jew, you see a tax collector for Rome as a traitor. He is cheating his own people to provide revenue for Rome, and he's getting rich off the misery of his own people. Now, go back to what that Virginia farmer said about Benedict Arnold. That is how most Jews would look at Levi. That they would despise that guy. He was a collaborator. He was a traitor. He was getting rich off their misery. They would have hated that guy. And so they're walking along, and Jesus stops, and he looks at the tax booth, and I kind of picture Jesus stopping and just looking and making eye contact with Levi. And somewhere behind Jesus, this is what I picture happening. Oh, he's fixing to roast that guy. Oh, yeah. See, this is what we signed up for. Look, he's looking. He sees a Jew in that tax booth, and he's fixing to let that dude have it. He's fixing it. Here it comes. And Jesus looks at him and says, follow me. Now, if you're Peter, because he tended to be the most outspoken. Now, let's not forget, James and John at one point asked Jesus if he wanted them to call down fire from heaven on some people. So while Peter may have been the most outspoken, James and John did not get the nickname Sons of Thunder for no reason. So if you're Peter or Andrew, or maybe better, James and John, how do you react when Jesus invites a tax collector to join your group. You're probably furious, right? Was that a joke? Did we hear that right? What do you reckon are the chances that one of those guys walked up to Jesus and went, "Hey, do you know what that guy is? I know you've been out in the wilderness doing stuff. Maybe you're not familiar with how taxes work. I don't know. You do know what this guy is, right?" If they don't address that conversation directly with Jesus, you know that conversation is happening back in the back. What are they doing? What is he doing? Does he not know? We're not going to have any credibility at all. Because how many people you reckon in Capernaum know who Levi is? I mean, the guy's infamous in that city. He has to be. Whole sections of the city know this guy by sight and hate him. They can't stand him. He is a traitor to the Jews. And Jesus has just walked up and he looks at the guy and he says, "Follow me." Now, for our purposes this morning, I want to ask you a really simple question. Of all the eligible people in Israel to follow Jesus, why did he pick a tax collector? I mean, he's picked fishermen. He's going to pick a zealot. By the way, a zealot is on the opposite end of the spectrum. Simon the Zealot is the guy who wants to take up arms against Rome and invade them right now. He's that guy. He's the guy with his feet on Pelosi's desk taking selfies the other day. That's Simon the Zealot. Except Simon would have had probably a bazooka with him or something. Simon the Zealot wants to invade Rome. He hates the Roman. The only good Roman is kind of like what I say about snakes. Only good snake, dead snake. Only good Roman, dead Roman. I can only imagine if Simon the Zealot is already a follower, what his facial expression is when Jesus picks Matthew. But for our purposes today, it's a really great question. Why does Jesus pick this guy? I mean, there was tons of people he could have picked. He saw what, there you go. He saw what he had the potential to become. But let's be honest. Weren't there a lot of people in Israel with that kind of potential? I am a firm believer, if you go through the New Testament, nothing in there is there by accident. I don't think anything, I think everything had a purpose, everything had a reason, and I think there is a real message for us in this story if we actually stop to look at it. I don't think Matthew was a random choice where Jesus just was like, "I'm going to walk through Capernaum and I'm going to pick the seventh guy I see." One, two, three. I think he picked this guy for a reason. I think it's a message to us. There is no philosophical thing that cannot be overcome within the boundaries of the love of Christ. I want to teach my church something 2,000 years from today. I want to teach them an important lesson. I can make Matthew and James and John coexist because they love me. I'm going to teach my church that the people we despise the most can be our brothers in Christ if we exist under the love of Christ. And how am I going to do that? I'm going to take these four fishermen who probably hate a tax collector more than anything in the world. And I'm going to take a tax collector and I'm going to stick him in the group with him. Here he is. Matthew, come on in. And you can kind of imagine that Peter, Andrew, James, and John are back there going, "Oh, he's not coming. He's not coming. He hates his people. He's not coming." It says, when Matthew heard that, when Levi heard that, it says, he got up and followed him. Now, it's a real simple question. Why would Matthew leave all his money, his position of authority, his power. Why would he leave all that to follow Jesus? Maybe he was tired of being hated. Maybe he was tired of being hated. Maybe there were a lot of reasons. But you know what? The most fundamental, basic, let's not, and this is one of those things where let's not look past the obvious. You know why he left? Because he was invited. He was invited. Instead of looking at Matthew and seeing him as an undesirable, instead of looking at Matthew and seeing him as somebody who was not wanted, instead of looking at Matthew and seeing him as a traitor and irreconcilable, Jesus looked at him and went, that guy. I can do something with that guy. And if Jesus had just walked by his booth that day, I think it's almost impossible the idea that Levi would have closed up shop and taken off behind Jesus. I think it took the invitation. Any of you ever felt unwanted? Now, if you take a minute and think about that, it's like, whew. There's not many things that feel worse than when you just feel unwanted. When you have a perception that other people don't want you around, that a particular group of people are not interested in you, they don't care about you, you know, that is one of the worst feelings in the world, when you feel like nobody wants you, when you just feel like I'm dead to everybody. Nobody cares about me. And that's probably the position that Matthew found himself in. Now, whether or not he earned that feeling is not the issue. The fact of the matter is that Matthew had probably reached that point as a tax collector where he was probably dead to his own family. It's unlikely his own parents wanted anything to do with him because he had created this thing where he was so hated by the Jews, he would have been an embarrassment to his family. And so Jesus stops and he looks at him and he says, you, come with me. Follow me. Now, why? Why would Jesus call this guy? Like I said, when you think about all the vast number of people who were eligible to be called by Jesus, what was it specifically that motivated Jesus to call this individual that had no reason to expect a call from Jesus? And I think Jesus is trying to teach us something. Peter, Andrew, James, John. Here's your new best buddy. Tax collector. By the way, how long do you think it took for them to become friends? I would guess it took some time. I'm guessing it took some time. I'm not thinking that when that happened, the four of them were like, yay! Well, we've always wanted a tax collector with us. This is amazing. Jesus, you're so smart. That's exactly what we wanted. So you've got this, now you've got this interesting mix where you've taken a tax collector and you've thrown him into the pot with these other guys, and probably as Jesus is leaving that place and Matthew now is walking, and Matthew probably stayed close to Jesus. And behind him, the guys, you can just almost hear them. What is he doing? What's wrong with him? He just called us because we're amazing. So why did he call that guy? And you can almost imagine that, because Jesus always knew what everybody was thinking, right? So you can imagine Jesus walking away, he's just smiling. He's like, oh, they don't even have a clue. They don't get it. They don't get it. And 2,000 years later, the question is, do we get it? Do we understand the significance of what Jesus does in that very simple moment where he stops and he looks at someone who is totally undesirable? Now, some of you may be thinking, oh, well, okay, but Stuart, they didn't love that guy while he was a tax collector because he changed. And that is very true. And by the way, how long does it take to change? Any of you ever tried to change? It kind of depends on the motivation, right? It depends on the motivation. And even then, there's this subconscious thing, right? Any of you ever picked up a bad habit and you tried to stop it? And I'm not talking about like a chemical thing like cigarettes. Like I've had friends who smoked and tried to stop, and because of the nicotine addiction stuff, they had a hard time. I'll give you a really good example. I bite my fingernails. So when I was a kid, my mother decided she's going to break me of that. So she bought this stuff. I think it was called Stop Bite or something. And it was like fingernail polish. You remember that stuff? You remember my mom using it on me? Did it work? I still bite my fingernails. Yeah. I may bite them during the sermon this morning just if I get nervous. She put that stuff on. And I kept right on biting them. And she looked at me one night and she said, by the way, I got in trouble for this. I might have got a whooping for this. She said, how can you bite your fingernails with that nasty taste and stuff on your fingers? How do you do it? And I said, you make me eat stuff I don't like all the time. I said, if I can eat a collard or a sweet potato, I can bite my fingernails. The next morning when I came to, but I distinctly remember that was it. I was like, hey, you make me eat stuff I don't like all the time. And that stuff I don't even enjoy. I like biting my fingernails, so hey, I'm taking one for the team. You know what? To this day, I'll bite my fingernails and not even realize I'm doing it. It's a subconscious thing. Now, my wife will tell you that's not my least endearing trait. There are two other things I do that irritate her to varying degrees. I bounce my leg when I'm sitting at the kitchen table. Any of you do that? Yes. Drives her crazy. My wife missed her calling. She should have been a seismologist because any vibration in the floor, she picks it up. And so if I start moving my leg, she will reach over on the table and grab my leg. And it's not even until she does that that I realize I'm doing it. Anybody else do that? Any leg shakers in here? Okay. The other thing is, and this one sounds worse than it is because I don't smoke weed, but I roll paper. You okay, Sam? Sam, don't laugh like that. You'll have people thinking I'm lying. For some reason, I get a receipt, and I'll sit there and just, I'll not even be thinking, I'll just roll it. I roll it into this little roll of paper. And then I'll set it on the counter for some reason, and my wife will come in and go, why are all these up here? And I'll be like, I don't know, baby, I'm sorry, and I'll throw them away. But I still do it. If I go out to eat tonight, I'll probably sit there, and while I'm talking to somebody, I'll start rolling that paper. It's a nervous habit. Any of you have nervous habits? Please, somebody else has a nervous habit. Okay. So we understand when we have something that is ingrained in us, it's hard to change, even when we are making a conscious effort to change. And so it's not like we have it in this, I think we have it in our minds sometimes that if we try to get somebody connected to Jesus, that you know what's gonna, there's gonna be this magical change that takes place. And every bad quality they have is just going to disappear. Is that how it worked for you? No, that's not how it worked. So we understand that when Christ comes into our life, it's a process. And I kind of picture that over the next year or so, there was probably a process by which these guys begin to forgive each other. Begin to accept each other, begin to feel differently about each other. But I don't think it happened overnight. And the question is, why would Jesus do this? Wouldn't it make it more complicated? If he's calling disciples, why would he put such a toxic mix of people together? And I think it was because he wanted to set an example for his church. I think he wanted us 2,000 years later to recognize that the church is not supposed to be a group of homogenous people that all think alike. That was never what the church was intended to be. The church was intended to be different people from different walks of life that had Jesus Christ in common. And over time, they didn't become more like each other. They became more like him. And I think we've lost that. I think we've totally forgotten that concept. That God did not call us all to think just alike, like each other. That when somebody joins a church, I'm going to win them over to my political point of view. What's supposed to happen is when we become Christians, we're supposed to be won over to Jesus's political point of view. And a lot of us don't even want anything to do with that. That we don't want anything to do with that. But the reality is that's what's happened, is that we now look at people and we judge people by, well, they don't think like me. We disagree on these things. Therefore, and by the way, this is the toxic level that we've reached as a culture. You know what? I don't agree with you. I don't want anything to do with you. Now, let me ask you a question. How is the church supposed to reach out to a lost world when we don't want anything to do with people who aren't like us? Would the church invite Matthew today to come follow Jesus? Or would we look at Matthew and go, I don't want anything to do with that guy. He's too far gone. Don't want anything to do with him. Don't want anything to do with him. You know, in fact, if the church today, the way they function, here's what we'd have. We'd have Jesus and the 12 fishermen, right? Because I've already got four, so I'm just going to get eight more just like these guys. And that way they'll all get along and they can talk about fishing and we'll all have that in common. It'll be awesome. We'll just have a homogenous group. And here's what we'll do. We'll go throughout Israel and we'll save fishermen. And that's it. If you're not a fisherman, well, you're not really part of what we're trying to do. But it's so fascinating when we look back at this story and we take a minute to think about what was going on in this moment where Jesus stops and he looks at the least desired person in Israel, just about. And by the way, if you're going, oh no, there were worse, think about this let's just read verse 15 and you'll see it. And it happened that he was reclining at the table in Matthew's house. So that night, Jesus, after he calls Matthew, says, oh, by the way, you're invited to a party we're having tonight. Oh, cool, where's it at? Your house. We're having a party at your house. And Matthew's like, awesome. So it says, as it happened that night, he was reclining at the table in Matthew's house, and many tax collectors and sinners were dining with them. Now, take a minute to absorb this. There are two... classifications of bad people. There are tax collectors and all other sinners. If you're not certain how hated tax collectors were, that verse tells you all you need to know. And it happened that he was reclining at the table in his house with many tax collectors and sinners and dining with Jesus and his disciples. How uncomfortable. Well, first of all, let's try to get a mental image of what this party looks like. Matthew has probably contacted his boys, his tax collector boys, and he goes, hey, I'm having a party. Jesus is here. You guys got to come over and meet him. So we've got probably a group of tax collectors that Matthew knew from the Capernaum area and maybe even some of the outlying cities. They've all come over for supper. And then it just says, sinners. What do you think that includes? Prostitutes. Maybe some criminals. Yes, yeah, some adulterers. I mean, just some people who have been cast out of Jewish society by the Pharisees because they had failed to follow the law. And that could be any number of things. People who are unclean. I mean, you go down the line. So you've got the tax collectors and then these other undesirables. And then in the middle of all them is Jesus, who's probably loving it, and Peter, Andrew, James, and John, who are probably looking at each other going, what are we doing here? We're surrounded by the worst people in Israel. This is not what we envisioned when Jesus said, come on, follow me. So it happened, they're reclining at the table in his house, and the tax collectors and sinners were there with Jesus and the disciples. It says, for there were many of them. Now, It's interesting the way that sentence is constructed. In the Greek, it implies that the many of them were disciples. But depending on how you read it, it could mean that many of them, when it says there were many of them, that could have meant sinners and tax collectors. Regardless, there's a whole big group of people there. They were following him. All right, verse 16. Now the scribes and the Pharisees find out about this party. Now, who told the scribes and Pharisees that there was a big gathering at the tax collector's house? We don't really know, but somebody let them know. Cat got out of the bag. Pharisees show up. The scribes and the Pharisees saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors. And so they went up to his disciples. Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners? Now, if you ask John, John's probably going, I was wondering the same thing. That's a great question. I don't know why we're here. But if you notice in the text, Jesus doesn't give his disciples time to answer. And hearing this, Jesus said to them, it is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. I was reading an article a couple years ago, and I don't remember who wrote it. I couldn't quote it. I'm not going to try to quote it, and I'm not going to try to get specific about the numbers. But what was really funny was it said that on average, when church people were polled about have they invited anyone to church in the last year, it was a relatively small percentage that had actually invited someone to church. So we'll just stop right here. I don't want to show of hands, but I just want you to take a minute and think for a second. Ask yourself a really simple question. In the last year, did you invite anyone to church? In the last year, did you invite anybody to church? Okay. While you're thinking on that question, here was what was really interesting in the article. It said, of the people who invited someone to church in the previous year, and it was, I don't remember the exact number, but it was somewhere over 70%. It was like 73% maybe, I don't know, invited someone to church who already went to church. They just went to a different church. So it's like, you should really come to my church because it's better than your church. You should come to our church. Because normally, when you invite somebody to church, it's when they're complaining about their church. You're sitting there and somebody goes, my church is, they play this and they don't, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, you should come to my church. It's much better. So it was like 70% of the people that were inviting people to church who already went to church, which kind of makes you ask the question. I'm with you. I get it. Was that your guitar, Ken?
I don't think so.
That was Kaylee's. That had to be Kaylee's. Or Sam's. Oh, that would make sense.
They're all standing up.
They're all... None of them moved. Oh. By the way, if you're wondering, that's how God gives you an amen during church. He just strums somebody's guitar. There's like 77% of the people that were inviting people to church who already went to church. So here's the question. If a low percentage of Christians are inviting people to church and a high percentage of the ones who are inviting people to church are inviting people who already go to church, who's inviting the unchurched to church? And you know what the answer is? No one. Now here's the question. Why are we inviting the unchurched to church? Well, Stuart, they wouldn't fit in our place. They wouldn't fit in our place. I mean, they don't even know the rules. They might open communion on the wrong end and the juice will fall out or something. They don't know. They may use inappropriate language in the building. Yeah, heaven forbid they do that. Like they should be like the rest of us and wait till we get outside. Well, Stuart, I can't invite that person. I thought about asking them, but Stuart, they don't vote for the people we vote for. What? They don't think like we do. They don't act like we do. By the way, why do they need to know Jesus? I mean, that's what Jesus said, right? I came for the sick, The healthy don't need the doctor. But that's what we do. We're inviting people to church who already go to church. And when we stop and think about it, we go, how did this happen? How did we become this? How did we become this? Where we are so bothered by people who don't think like us politically or philosophically or morally that we decided, well, we don't want them in church. They would never fit in. Isn't that the whole point? Isn't that the whole point? It's the whole point of Jesus calling Matthew, right? Why did Jesus call Matthew? Because he was just one of the boys? No. He had nothing in common with any of the guys that were following him. So why'd he call him? He had potential. He had potential. By the way, any of you ever felt like you had more potential than other people recognized? Probably a lot of you went, oh yeah, man. Yeah. I've got more potential. In fact, some of you who have reached your potential, you ever wonder why you reached it? Was it because somebody saw that potential in you? When I was a student at Johnson, I was a ne'er-do-well Bible college student. I was not on anyone's list of anyone significant. In fact, I've shared this a while back when I was at college for a reunion a few years ago. The youth ministry professor saw me. She goes, oh, Stuart, what are you doing now? I said, I'm the senior minister of church. She goes, no, really, what are you doing? I said, no, I'm serious. I've been the senior minister at University Church of Christ for 18 years. She goes, oh, no, come on, serious. Come on, don't mess with me. I said, no, I'm serious. And one of my friends came over and goes, he's telling the truth. And she goes, oh, I always knew you had it in you. I'm like, I'm not feeling like that's true at all. But when I was there, I did have a professor who reached out to me as a sophomore and put a message in my box when they said, come to my office and see me. I didn't even have this guy for a class. And I went to his office and we sat down and he goes, I've been watching you. By the way, when I was in Bible college, that was the last thing I wanted to hear from faculty. I've been watching you. I'm like, and the first thing that goes to your mind, well, what did you see? Where was I? What? He said, no. He goes, I think you have tremendous potential. You know, 2 years of Bible college, that's the first time anybody ever said that to me. Shocker, I know. Because you would think that the potential was just oozing out of me, but no. But this one professor, and I was a communications major, and he said, you've got a tremendous amount of potential. He goes, I love the way you think. Now, there's something I don't hear very often. He said, I love the way you think outside of the box. And he goes, you don't just accept. He goes, you know, in a college where we want everybody to march in a line, and you're like, I'm not marching in that line. He goes, I love that about you. And we became friends. And he actually came here just a couple years after I became senior minister and did an eldership seminar. And we've stayed friends over the year. And he's still a professor at Johnson. And he teaches English, so my kids are trying to avoid him. But he's a good dude. But here was the thing. He took time to look at me in that vast group of Bible colleges and said, that kid, I see something in him, and he needs help to achieve his potential, but I'm going to invest some time in him. And he invested a lot of time in me. When we think about this story, and we think about that Jesus, as he's walking through Capernaum, and on all sides of him are good Jews. I mean, he's passing good Jews in the streets. Every few steps, there's a good Jew, there's a good Jew, there's a good one. Lots of potential here. These are guys who already believe. And then he stops in front of the tax collector's booth. And he goes, of all the people in the last four streets I could have called, I want you to come with me. I want you to follow me. And why would he do that? And so when we're out functioning as part of the church, as the body of Christ, as we're out functioning and we're looking around going, no, no. No, and it's, oh, Stuart, I'd invite some people to church who run church, but I just don't know any that would be, I just don't know if we'd want those people here. Well, let me just say this. If we don't want those people here, then we're not the church Jesus Christ died for.
Amen.
We're not the church he was trying to communicate with when he called Matthew the least qualified guy in Israel to be a disciple. When he called that guy and said, come with me. And Matthew's like, why me? And I can almost hear Jesus just saying, because I'm going to teach my church a lesson for the next 2,000 years. I want them to understand that it's not the most qualified. Sometimes it's the person who least qualified, who on the outside doesn't looks totally like the wrong person. And all it takes is for somebody to stop and look at that person and give them an invitation. Give them an invitation. We live in an exceptionally polarized society. And it's getting worse. We are inundated with conspiracy theories and political intrigue. We are the angriest generation. We're constantly upset. Social media has given everybody a platform to say whatever they want to. Sometimes. But ultimately, the church needs to stop and ask itself a question. How did the world get to this point, and what is our role in it? Are we feeding into that stuff? Or are we fighting against that stuff? And what's unfortunate is, when I get on social media and I look at social media, more often than not, the church is just throwing wood in there. There's a fire, but it ain't big enough. Let's throw some wood in there. And that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate that that's what we've become. It is a hard thing to change for those of us who, and trust me, as a history teacher, I pay attention to politics. I watch it. I told somebody the other day, I said, oh, what a time to be alive if you're a history teacher. What a time to be alive. I had my first history class of the semester on Tuesday. We didn't even talk about history. We just talked about current events. And one of the kids was like, Mr. Woodley, how did we get here? I'm like, I'm glad you asked. We'll be spending the next 15 weeks exploring that very question. Starting, oddly enough, with the period after the last Civil War. How did we get here? As a church, we need to be asking the same question. How did we get to this place? If Jesus came back today and he walked in the door of our church and he said, guys, how many of you think I'm happy with the state of my church today? How many of you would feel comfortable standing up saying, yeah, I feel like we're doing pretty good? Nobody else could stand up with me? Is that what we'd say to Jesus if he walked in right now? Would he be pleased with what we've become? Now, I want to be clear as we close this morning. I'm asked the praise team to come up and lead us in our communion hymn this morning. This is not a call to become apolitical. I'm not telling people in the church they shouldn't vote or shouldn't have political opinions or shouldn't have opinions on morality or any of these. I'm not saying that. That's not what I'm saying. I can't stress that enough. But I will say this. When our political affiliation prevents us from being evangelistic to people, then your political affiliation has become a problem. If you today, and I realize that most of the people in this room are conservative, and that's fine. Here's my point to you. If you've become so Republican that you can't invite a Democrat to church, you're too Republican for Jesus. Okay? If we've become so politically motivated that we can't reach out to people who have a different political view than us because we don't want those people in our church, you've become too political for Jesus. You've become too political for Jesus. Jesus came to save people, not political institutions, not governments. He came to save people. 2,000 years ago, the Pharisees could not see Jesus for who he was because they were more interested in their nation than their souls. Are we becoming the same thing? I want to challenge you today to really ask yourself, why Matthew? Why did he ask that guy? And what is the lesson that I personally can learn from Jesus calling the unwanted to be one of his disciples?